Succession number 9437, Reel 9.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 9. Did you have any problems with dust? You know, it implies that this area was dusty. Yes,
August was terrible. The winds would come in from the desert, from the Tibetan desert, and it would be very, very dusty. And then following that, we got rain, and, of course, the mud was absolutely ghastly. The summers, of course, are hot. I've only talked about it being very cold in the winter, and it was very cold in the winter, but very dry, and a sort of cold you can really, it's quite easy to take. But you had to be careful. I mean, if you touched metal latches, your fingers stuck to them if you were wet. It really was cold. But the summers also were very hot, but again, the dry heat that is easy to take. But at the end of the summer, we got these dust storms, and then the rain before autumn came. And you had all this mud to deal with, and you were asking in Yunnan whether it was difficult to get from one cave to another. Well, we were only in Yunnan in the winter, where of course ice could be a problem, but in the summer, in the rains, it was really very difficult getting up and down some of these paths.
Did you have snow as well?
Snow. David was born on the 15th of November, and snow fell then, and from then on until March or so, there was always snow on the ground in the shaded area, shaded parts. There was always snow. We had a lot of sun too, which melted the snow that was exposed. But any snow that was in the shade stayed right round till the spring and from the middle of
November.
Did
you have to move through snow at all?
No. Well, they never had any big hospital moves through the snow. When the village David was born was about 2 miles from headquarters, and some people did walk through the snow to the headquarters, but no big moves were planned in the winter.
Could I ask you now about the various villages you went through and what you learned about village life in China in those two areas, which would have been Shenxi and Shanxi, wouldn't
yes.
they?
The villages are mostly quite small, with perhaps 20 to 50 families. They tend to have several caves grouped together with one courtyard, which would have a mud brick wall round a courtyard in the front, often with thorns and things put on the top of the wall to try and keep out wolves and other predators that might come at night. And there'd also be the latrine in one corner. The better caves would have a millstone in the courtyard for grinding their grain, the top stone sometimes would be hidden away because they would be quite valuable, or possibly they passed from family to family, and these would be operated with usually a mule or a donkey to pull it round, or if you couldn't afford it you could push it round yourself. Very heavy things raised off the ground. In the season, they would come and with beautifully made willow baskets for holding the seed and the flower, and things like rather like superior dustpans, where they could shake the grain and separate the chaff from the grain, and they'd blindfold the animals when they were working these mills because they were going round and round in small circles. They'd also have plots near any water source where they could grow crops like maize and things that and green vegetables and peas and beans. They'd grow too that needed irrigation up on the hills. Anything that wasn't was below 45 degrees was not ploughed, but they had. Instruments. Well, they did have ploughs as well for anything that was flat, but most of the hacking up of the ground to use for fields was done with things like sort of oversized hoes, which had sharp edges, which they'd put over their shoulder and strike the ground and lift up big sods and turn it over. But that they'd grow winter wheat up on the hills on those fields, and the ground was not very productive, and the plants would be about each individual plant would be about 10 inches from the next one, and the crop was very small. That would be winter wheat or millet. They'd grow in fields like that too. But that also would be grown in the plains where it could be irrigated and the crop would be much better. They grew green vegetables and a lot of things of the squash family, marrows and so on. Some things they would that we'd never think of drying, they would dry to keep for the winter, like marrow and so on, things that have practically no flavour to us. But that would give them something for the winter. And if they could afford it, they would pickle greens. It's called swansea. That's bitter vegetable. They'd also make bean sprouts from beans by putting beans in bags in the river. And they'd have flocks of goats and sheep, which would be taken often by the children for pasture where there weren't any crops planted, and they'd have to chase up the mountains. Water, some villages had a well, some villages had springs. In one village we were in, there was a thing like an enormous stone bath, like an old-fashioned horse trough, you know, and the spring flowed into this, and it was a very, very good supply of water. Very easy to go and collect water for yourself. And but in other villages, perhaps the water source had changed, and they sometimes had to go as far as 3 miles for water. Washing was done, washing of clothes was done by the old whacking with a stone method, and then they'd spread things out in the sun to dry and to bleach. The hemp and something for making rope was grown in some places, and we'd see them making rope with long rope walks. In that part of the country, the men all wrapped their heads in towels. I think it's only in that area. Very typical, these towels wrapped around their heads. The shoes. I've described how we were given Chinese shoes, but I've not said how they were made. And we used to watch them doing this, because you start off with a bundle of old rags and a wooden board and a bowl of paste made from boiled flour and water. Flour boiled in water, like the paste we used to put wallpaper up in years and years ago. And they would take the cloth and get smooth, small pieces, not more than about 3 inches square, and they would paste them onto the board to make a rectangle of several layers, so that it was, and then they'd dry it in the sun, so it was like a thin sheet of cardboard. They would then cut a sole out of this thin sheet of cardboard, well, several, say five or six, according to what thickness sole they wanted, and they would then very carefully cover each of these soles with a piece of a flat cloth right over the whole piece, so that's got to be a bigger piece of cloth. Then they would make a stack of these all together, and they would sew them together with thread made from some sort of grass. And this was very amusing to me, because the Chinese ladies are very modest about their personal appearance. But when they wanted to make this thread, they'd roll their trousers right up to their hips and lick their hands and roll the thread on their upper thigh, which used to amuse me. And they must have had very strong needles, and they'd have some kind of a metal protection so they could push this needle with the thread through the cloth of these several layers of what was quite as stiff as cardboard to make the sole. And then they'd have quite a firm sole in the end. Then they'd make the upper out of cloth. For winter shoes, it would be two layers with padded cotton wool type in between. And I never understand how with any shoes they manage to sew the toe on, but they do. And so they make the shoes like that. The women are occupied a great deal of the time making shoes. And then they have areas that are for winnowing the corn. And I always wondered in the Bible where it says, "Don't muzzle the ox that treads the corn." And there in China, I saw the ox treading the corn. They put the whole sheaf on this platform, and they let the oxen pull a stone roller over it and trample the corn, And in that way, they can separate the straw from the grain, and then later they by throwing it in the air, they separate the grain from the grain from the chaff. And you can see the oxen walking around, and I suppose they do stop them chewing it up, but you know, the ideas there. Also, they had flails. That I'd seen in the Middle East too, that must go back into antiquity. You see them in medieval pictures in Europe, with the revolving head to the long pole, and they'd be flailing the corn, and they hadn't got the heavy roller and the animal to pull it round to separate the grain from the straw.
Did you notice a great variety of villages, you know, customs and practices in the different areas, and most language of them are, even?
Well, the accents in these villages is very difficult for the Chinese from other parts of China to understand. They're very poor, and they don't have much time for any activities. The men smoke quite a lot, little tiny pipes with tiny, weeny little bowls. They do grow tobacco. I think they smoke a bit of opium on the side. But
did you gather whether there was any sort of feeling about opium with the communists? Were they against it at all?
I think they were against it, but I don't think it was any great problem in an area that was so poor. So I don't think there was no... There certainly would have been animosity against anyone who was making money out of it or anything like that.
How were the villagers treated, you know, when you went in, this big group of people?
Well, I think they must have been very courteous to them, because I never saw any animosity or any people saying, oh, I don't want to move. They were always very reasonable with each other. And it was a give and take, and they were allowed to return if they'd left things behind they wanted. But that happened very rarely.
Were their properties respected, would you think?
I think so. Yes, I do. Mm. But mind you, their property was very, very little. In some caves you'd go, there'd be chest of drawers and perhaps a built-in cupboard, something like that. But in most people had nothing but perhaps a few chests, or possibly large earthenware jars for storing grain in, or possibly baskets made out of the split willow, that would hold grain. I mentioned the Kongs earlier. In the better homes, they'd have beautiful woven mats made from split cane to cover the area where you slept, because they were made from mud brick, and of course, with the friction, they would become dusty. But these made a nice smooth covering for them.
How about fuel? What did they use for fuel?
Now, fuel was very difficult. There is coal in the area, but of course, with no the transportation of coal would be so very, very difficult. Very little wood. In most areas, there was very little wood. I know sometimes the hospital used to send all the staff up to the hills to pick up anything that would burn, stuff like heather and bilberry and things like that. And I think the peasants must have had quite a lot of problems getting sufficient fuel. And you'd find if in areas where the nationalists had broken in, they would have used all the wood that was available and burnt it.
Did you see any evidence of their practice with night soil, for instance?
Oh, yes. That was all saved and taken out to put on their fields. Of course, they'd have special buckets and so on to carry it away. They were usually nice dark places, because that discourages the flies coming in. You're usually covered, had lids and so on.
Did you find that difficult to cope with at all?
Well, we'd been broken in easily with the ones from the Middle East. And we'd had, I suppose we hadn't had ones like that in nationalist China, though possibly they do occur everywhere.
A big group like you must have been very welcome in the villages.
I suppose we were, really, yes.
You must have added to their supply, because it is very important, isn't it, for agriculture?
Yes, oh yes, it is there. Well, when you're flying, I hadn't noticed it in that area, but certainly in other parts of China, as you fly over a town or village, you'll see that the area is much greener nearer the habitations than it is further out.
For that reason?
For that reason, yes. Mm.
Did this make any problems regarding the transmission of disease, do you think? The proximity of the excrement?
Well, I don't think we had typhoid there. They were more typhus, the diseases spread by lice, than the waterborne diseases. It's strange, really. There weren't too many waterborne diseases. And
what diseases did you see?
Well,
there
was smallpox among the hospital staff at one time when David was quite tiny, and several of the staff had it, but not badly. And David was vaccinated with Chinese vaccine. He ran a terrific great temperature, but anyway, he wasn't too bad. And then later, we did have quite an outbreak of smallpox, and I saw several very, very ill patients with smallpox, absolutely covered in spots from top to bottom.
Could you cope with that? I mean, did you have enough of this vaccine?
Well, you can't treat them. You vaccinate them before they get it. It's only good nursing once they've got it.
But in the areas, you know, with these cases,
no,
could you vaccinate?
I think the hospital staff were vaccinated, and probably some of the soldiers were vaccinated, but I don't think any attempt at that time was made to vaccinate the native population. But nevertheless, that was the sort of thing that the communists would certainly have gone ahead with. When we went back in the 70s, they had carried on a Kalazar elimination program, which the FAU had started in Honan, that was. And I'm sure preventive medicine and vaccination and so on would have become quite routine.
Did you have any idea what the infant mortality rate would have been?
Yes, it was high. When I said there weren't waterborne diseases, of course there was dysentery among the infants and young people. The infant mortality was high. I think if the mother couldn't feed the baby, the chance of the baby surviving was very, very slight. Among the party members, you heard wonderful stories about how they'd got sheep to feed the baby and so on. And there was one lovely story that the sheep had actually come and literally the baby had suckled from the sheep, and they'd put her in a petticoat or something. That was only a story. I don't know whether it's true or not. But I think there would be a certain amount of wet nursing, but I with a very poor diet that they had, I think the chance of a baby surviving if its mother wasn't fit would be very slight.
And would the death rate also have been high, do you think?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I had got written down that somewhere that a woman would perhaps have six children, but she wouldn't expect to have more than three grow to maturity.
Did you see beggars and cripples as you went on this very long march?
No, we never saw beggars. Never beggars. We did see one or two cripples. I remember a man who'd obviously fractured his femur and hadn't had it set at all. And, you know, his leg sort of wobbled around in a most peculiar way. That was merely through lack of a possibility. I mean, he couldn't possibly have had it to put in a plaster of Paris or anything. But so cripples were only people who'd been involved in accidents and hadn't been able to be treated. But we never saw beggars.
I'd like to ask you now about the hospital while you were on the move. You know, the sort of setting up of the hospital and then packing up again when the time came to move on. Can you remember the sort of shortest duration you would have been anywhere with the hospital, and the sort of longest period you had?
Well, I think the shortest time was probably the first time, because we had expected that to be permanent, and they went to a lot of trouble to put these glass windows into the caves that were to be used for the operating theatres. After that, we never tried to be so... Do you want to take that out? We never bothered to do anything like that. In fact, I think the windows must have been left behind at that point. And really, we only saw patients after that on... really had opened the hospital up properly on three other occasions, for much longer. Four other occasions. Once was from April the 21st till May the 25th. Then from May the 30th to August the 6th. Then we crossed the Yellow River, and we had the longest period in a village called Chabetai, from August the 21st till March the 22nd of the next year. And then we moved again, and from April the 29th till July the 10th, we had a hospital in another place.
So the hospital was set up in line with your stays in these different villages,
yes,
as you explained earlier.
Yes, I think that the position was fixed by, was arranged ahead by authorities higher than our hospital, and arrangements were made for transporting patients if there were any to be transferred. Sometimes we only took patients who still needed treatment, and the others would be left at home. The ones that didn't need a lot more treatment would be left in the previous village until they were able to be taken to their some other place to live, because our patients were very, very seldom local people. They were either communist soldiers who'd come from anywhere, could be anywhere in China, or sometimes they were Kuomintang prisoners.
I think you mentioned earlier that the local people were rather suspicious. Is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, they were. They were much... I've got a lovely picture of someone with shingles, with a marvellous pattern painted all over their abdomen, and they would rather stick to their old folk remedies, some of which, actually, were quite efficacious.
I'm wondering if you became interested in that, you know, the traditional Chinese medicine.
Not really then, no. We sort of didn't have the opportunity to study it properly, and anyway, in that area, everything that wasn't under the communists was extremely primitive.
Did you find, though, that people's attitudes were extreme? They either were against Western medicine or totally for it, you know, rejecting the traditional. Were they very keen on injections?
Everyone was keen on injections, I think, even the peasants. But they were rather frightened, not that they would have had injections there, but I think the peasants were so primitive, they were against anything that wasn't local and familiar to them.
Was it a great business setting up the hospital and then packing up again? You know, can you remember how long it would have taken to have got the thing
operational? It depended on the circumstances. I can remember when we arrived at one place, someone had become practically asphyxiated on the trip. He had been injured in the throat and something, it had healed up, but some nerve must have been involved. And I think his pharynx had closed up completely or something. And we had to operate the moment we got there. He was just plonked in a cave and we got a knife. That was all really we needed. And we did boil it up, but I don't think it actually came to the boil before he was so black in the face we thought we had to get on, and the doctor did a tracheotomy. He'd been... injured in the throat, as I say, and he had a permanent tracheotomy after that, and was kept on as a hospital cook, part of the hospital cook staff, with a tracheotomy. But that was really a life saved by quick action by the doctors. It was very exciting, really, and it was nice that it had a happy outcome.
Usually
it wasn't. Didn't take so long. The caves always seemed to be... They must have sent people ahead to get caves sorted out for the important things. It depended. Sometimes we took the great big steriliser with us, which stood about 6 feet high. Now, that would have taken some time to install. Sometimes we'd be without fuel and they'd have to improvise how they sterilised things. Some of them were not really very efficient, but you had to do the best you could.
That was your job, wasn't it?
Well, not really. The hospital staff was fairly efficient, and I found that my job was more to do things quickly for the English-speaking doctors because of their lack of Chinese. So my part was a very minor role, really, because the theatre staff were quite well... I concentrated on the theatre while Margaret Stanley did the wards. And my job... The staff were so well trained, and they knew... Of course, as they worked with Doug particularly, they got so that they knew what he wanted anyway. And my job became less and less significance.
You're talking, of course, of the Chinese staff,
aren't
you?
Of the Chinese staff, yes.
Yes.
My husband used to give anaesthetics only when a doctor was present. Spinal anaesthetics, mostly.
Yes. Well, what sort of work would the Chinese doctors do and the nurses? You know, would they have the same responsibility?
Well, the Chinese foreign-trained doctors usually worked in a different part of the hospital from us and carried out the same sort of work as Doug and Peter did in our section. So the sections, because it was simple to have the sections in different villages just a few miles apart, so that we were in contact and you could meet for consultation. And, of course, these there were three foreign-trained doctors involved most of the time, I think. Of course, they were needed in other places too because of their ability, and they had to go to headquarters and things like that. But we didn't really work in the same sections after a while. In Yunnan, we'd more or less all work together. But once we got out into the countryside, the hospital sections were divided up.
And how about the Chinese people that you were training? You know, would you have taken on fresh recruits, as it were, and trained them right up? Or would they have had some?
The training was far less formal than we had expected when we got there to have a proper formal training. Really, training was quite haphazard and organised by the Chinese themselves. There were some nurses with us who were fairly senior and would advise on what should happen to the nurses, and because of the language problems, most of that was left to the Chinese themselves.
I was wondering about the barefoot doctors that one hears about. You know, was that scheme then
It
underway?
Wasn't operational then, but we could see the beginning of it because, as I say, just as nurses became doctors automatically, the barefoot doctors would have grown out of the recruits who'd been in hospital only a short time and had had a chance to see dressings done and injections given and so on, and would have had some classes in elementary hygiene and so on. But it wasn't official. There was no official system at that time. The country was still much too chaotic to get anything as elaborate as that going.
Had you any idea where the medical personnel were coming from? For instance, the educated Chinese who are coming up from the cities to the Yan'an area, would they have been interested in medicine, or was there rather more a feeling against it, do you think?
Yes, medicine was rather low down the scale, yes. A soldier was considered far more important than a nurse or a medical orderly. And I don't know about real foreign-trained doctors, but certainly the medical workers were quite low down the social scale, and in some ways it was considered quite undignified to be a medical worker.